good afternoon to all of you. It's good to be here again, to see you. I'm beginning to be more familiar. When I first came up here, it was like going to Africa. You know where you're going, you know? And when I've gotten up here now, we almost remember the exit, except we always turn too quickly down here off the exit, and we end up making a sharp turn left then. But we're glad to be here, and also names are starting to come. Like Kiefer is a name I can remember. I can't remember every individual's, but there's a big bunch of Kiefers up here. I know that. So we know that. So anyway, we're very pleased to be here, and it is much more familiar, and we've gotten to know Mr. Hansen. Really appreciate that, and very glad to be here today. All right, guys. You get in trouble with your wife, this is a good thing to give her. But this flower, this orchid, well, it's kind of common. I went down to Kroger's yesterday and picked it up. And if I get in trouble with my wife, I'll give it to her afterwards, okay? But this orchid, rather common. And yet, this plant is really a miracle. People don't think about it. Why? Because they're so common. Now, I'm not going to tell you what the miracle is, so you're going to have to guess, okay? Guys, it is not the miracle of getting your wife to get you out of trouble, all right? I'll tell you, it's not that one, all right? But there is something about this that's really incredible. And I'll tell you the story of it at the end of this sermon, if I don't ruin the flower first. Well, brethren, we are in the days of the holy days. And these holy days, these spring holy days, are associated with many of the miracles, the most spectacular miracles in the Bible. I think especially you heard about the death of Jesus Christ and the announcements and by Mr. Hansen. And you think about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And without that resurrection, Christianity would have not survived. It wouldn't have been anything. But without the miracles, even in the Old Testament. So tonight, title of today's sermon is The Spring, Holy Days, and Faith. The Spring, Holy Days, and Faith. When you read or go on, a lot of you probably get the Discovery Channel. Any of you get the Discovery Channel here? The History Channel, H2 now, what is it? The military history used to be, they call it something else now. All these channels, at this time of year, you're going to see all kinds of specials come out. And they're going to start explaining to you how the miracles of the Bible can be explained away. One of them is a volcano, by the way. I don't know how that works, but they got that figured out, supposedly. You name it, they've got it. And they just don't believe in miracles. So let's go to a dictionary definition now of a miracle. An effect or extraordinary event in the physical world that surpasses all known human or natural powers and is ascribed to supernatural cause, to a supernatural cause. Such an effect manifesting or considered as a work of God, a wonder or a marvel, a wonderful or surprising example of some quality. So miracles are associated with the supernatural. Now, do you know that many of the scientists of this world today do not believe in miracles? You know why? Because they violate natural law, they say. Well, that's really sad, isn't it? Because if you believe in God, who made the natural laws? Where did they come from? They come from God. If he wants to change a law or do something that violates, quote unquote, their idea of law. And so actually, this very definition, brethren, shows that the scientists of this world who believe in all these natural causes causing everything have missed the boat. I mean, they've missed it because they define God out of the situation. They've eliminated him. Let's go to one of the first miracles of the Bible, Exodus 3. This is one of the places you'll find. And of course, we know this is from God. We can understand that this is literally something that happened. And again, they're always trying to say that these didn't happen or that they misunderstood what was going on. And it's amazing what they will say. All right. So notice that Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father. And the priest of Midian, and he fled the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flame of fire. And from the midst of the bush, so he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight. Why the bush does not burn. So, again, go back to our definition of a miracle, an extraordinary event. How many of you have gone out in the woods and saw a bush burning by itself? I don't know about you. I never have. All right? Furthermore, let's think about something else this bush does. It talks. You see what I mean? It talks. Now, we know it's God talking. I don't mean to, you know, make fun of that at all. It's a very serious thing, of course, because Moses is told, as he's talking, and of course, this is God talking through the bush, and Moses is told to take his shoes off because the place he's standing on is holy ground, which we've always understood is one of the ways explained about the Sabbath, that the Sabbath is holy time. And there was a spot, and that's where God was, and said, you need to take off your shoes. So that's what he did. Take off your sandals, off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. So again, how do they explain this? Well, they have a bush. By the way, this is an idea for the bush. They have a bush. It's called the Catamus albus, sometimes called the gas plant. So that's how they explain this. That the gas plant on a bush somehow spontaneously combusts. But the first thing I would bring up to them is, does it talk also? Please. You see how they will stretch the Bible? What they do, they take the Bible and stretch it. But how can you know that it's God talking there? We can't prove it, can you? By scientific methods. Because we can't go back in time. That's one of the problems that people have with the miracles of the Bible. You can't go back and prove them scientifically. For instance, you know, if I took this book of mine or this notebook here, whatever, and dropped it to the floor, you can stop. I can calculate. It takes, 1.5 seconds or something? And then you can calculate it. And then I can experiment. But you can't go back in time and take the Bible and say, okay, I'm going to see this again. CNN wasn't there yet. Sorry, folks. But there was an eyewitness. And especially New Testament, we'd understand this to be an eyewitness account of Moses himself. And of course, even today we have eyewitness accounts. So, you know, it's very important. And this is something that's misunderstood about the Bible. Some people say, well, the Bible is not a scientific book. And in one way, that's true. It's true in the sense that the Bible is not to tell you how fast the speed of light is. Or how strong as a gravity. But it is something else that science can help in, by the way. And it's history. And that's where the problem comes. It's history. It's not science. There's no claim to say. But scientists claim that they proved it's untrue, or they'll try to say it's proved it untrue, like Noah's flood. They'll say, well, where's all the water from? And they forget a very important point. Who was a flood caused by? God. Well, who made water? God. If God wants to make more water, does he make more water? Yes. Did Jesus multiply the bread? Yes. So God could take one molecule and just make more. So it's really sad when we come to the spring holy days that faith is set aside. And that's something I want to really get across in the sermon today, that ultimately, brethren, it is faith. Even if you could prove every factor of the Bible, you could prove, you know, where certain people lived, the Philistines and the Egyptians, and you could prove that Moses left Egypt at a such and such a time, and all of that, well, would that prove the miracles happen? See, because you have to believe in something. There's, at some point, all you have is faith. And that's all there is to it. Let's go to the frogs now. I won't go through every thing in the Bible, but a lot of times, sometimes they'll explain the blood that's talked about in the book of Exodus and say, well, there's a volcano came. And then when the volcano comes and destroys the water, then what happens to the water? becomes polluted. And when the water becomes polluted, what happens? Well, the frogs come out. See? So let's go to Exodus 8 and verse 3. And what happens is when you see this, and people try to explain it logically from just a purely no God view, they ignore the scriptures. It's just like they're a fictitious thing. And that's where it takes faith, frankly. And it's a very, very important thing that we have faith in God's word. In verse chapter 8 and verse 1, and the Lord spoke to Moses and said, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go. In verse 2, but if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite you with a territory with frogs. Now, notice where it says the frogs came from. It's the same thing with the water. You know, these guys come up and they say the water was caused by some kind of volcano or something happened and it polluted the water. But it doesn't just say that it was in the river. It doesn't say that at all. Notice it says, so the water shall bring forth frogs abundantly and shall go up and come into your house, into your bedroom. How about that for having a bed partner, huh? A frog jumping all over you. And that's what happened to them. It was even in Pharaoh's place, apparently. They had all kinds of frogs all over the place. In your bed, in the houses of your servants, on your people, in your ovens. Wow, how about having a cake and there out jumps a frog, huh? That would be an exciting cake, wouldn't it? And the frogs shall come up on you and on your people and on your servants. And notice in verse 5, and the Lord said, stretch out your hand over the streams. Oh, wait a minute. It's not just a river. See? Over the ponds. Well, wait a minute. The ponds aren't fed by a river. There might be an underground creek or something like that. See? The ponds are probably a little higher than the river. It doesn't just come from one location. The same thing with the water. Now, that was one thing where a place where I thought Cecil B. DeMille's. Remember the old movie, Ten Commandments? And was it Charlton Heston's pouring out the water? That was one of the best. And it turns to blood. I don't know if it happened. I don't think it happened that way. But it was dramatic on what really, in a way, did happen. It wasn't just the river where the water was turned to blood. It wasn't just the frogs come out of the river. They came out of the ponds. They came out of all kinds of places. But what they will say is that, well, the frogs were, you know, made to go out of the river. And so, therefore, again, you know, it was a natural thing. But again, what they do is they ignore the scriptures. And notice, and Aaron stretched forth his hands then. And notice in verse 7. This is another interesting part of this story. Where we know that there is a demonic world out there. That can do miracles. Just not the same miracles as God. They can mimic, I guess, God's miracle. I don't know how exactly it works. But we know that they can do some supernatural things. It happens a lot. You can see it in the New Testament too. And notice in verse 7, and the magicians did so with their enchantments. So they brought frogs up too. So there's a certain amount of power. Now, when you read the commentaries, or you can read the text itself, God just doesn't do miracles in the book of Exodus just because he's, you know, interested in killing some people or whatever. He does these miracles with a specific purpose. He very clearly shows the purpose. And the purpose was to show that the Egyptian gods were helpless against the God of the Hebrews. Now, these weren't just, you know, sideshows, like a Barnum and Bailey show where they have somebody do something that looks, you know, spectacular. These were done with a very purpose. It's the same with Jesus Christ's miracles. They weren't done just for a sideshow. They were done with the purpose of showing who Jesus Christ was. And that's another thing, important thing about miracles and faith, is that they are done with a purpose. When you have a miracle happen to you, and I'll talk about some in our lives, it affects you, doesn't it? If you have some very unusual event that you didn't expect, then you start to look, oh, how did this happen? And it happens occasionally. All right, let's go to another. I'm not going to cover all of them. You can look it up. And if you want to get bored sometime, read those, you know, listen to those things. In Discovery Channel, and they'll have something on it. And that, well, what about the miracles of Exodus? But let's go to one of the most spectacular of all, of course, the parting of the Red Sea, Exodus 14, which you'll probably hear about later on the last holy day. And so here's one of the great miracles of the Bible. Now, it's interesting, years ago, I was looking at somebody that was skeptical about Christ's miracles, and he said, well, I can understand how he could heal. Because what he was talking about was spontaneous healing, like you even see with cancer patients sometimes, for whatever reason, somebody does something different and they are healed. That's what he's trying to explain. But you know what this person said? But I can't explain the healings or the miracles of nature, walking on the sea, you know, multiplying the bread, the sea, the storm stopping. He admitted that was something different. There's no way explaining that except that Jesus Christ was God. And he had these powers with him. And of course, one of the amazing things to me in the Bible says specifically, of course, why Pharaoh followed him. I mean, you talk about bad logic. You know, in the first place, his land is devastated. His firstborn is dead. Even the firstborn in prison is dead, by the way. And they have another explanation for that, by the way, if you look in some of the programs, why it's the firstborn, because they're in barns or something. I even forget. It's so ridiculous, you just say, forget it. And all of these things are happening. And he's got, what, one time there's darkness? And the Israelites are in light, but the Egyptians are in blackness? I don't know how you explain that naturally, by the way. All right? And then they leave. You'd think, boy, I'm sure glad to get rid of those folks. You know, we didn't have a very good time. But what does he do? He gets mad. Of course, we know the Bible says that God hardened his heart. The logical thing was, let those people go. They got our jewels and all that. And so let them go. But they don't, do they? They follow them. So Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered in the land. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them. Verse 4, Exodus 14. And over all the army, and that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. So again, notice this. These miracles happen with a very specific purpose. To show that this Bible, and it's going to be written down for us. And later on, it's told, and Moses told, you know, write these stories down. Tell them to your children. Remind them of them. Why? Because this is the supreme God. It's not Buddha. It's not Moloch. It's not any of these guys. Just like Elijah did, you know, when he came to the prophets of Baal. And he brought down the fire and they couldn't do it. They couldn't do anything. But what's so interesting about all these miracles, by the way, and there are exceptions, of course, which I'll talk about later here a little bit. But do miracles really convert people? You know, sometimes the atheists say, well, show me a miracle. Well, okay, are they going to be converted? What did Jesus do? He walked around healing. Anybody touched him practically was healed. Did the Pharisees say, oh, boy, something's up here. We better change. What did they do? They got mad. They got angry. Now, let's give one of the examples here. Let's say they found Noah's Ark. Do you think everybody would believe? Well, if they really found it, and I don't think they have, by the way, and I'm kind of wondering if they ever will, but it could be, you never know. But they ever found it, there'd be an explanation, wouldn't there? Because we know that because from science, we have proven that the cell is so complicated, it could never have evolved. The scientists admit they don't know what happened to the origin of life, but they say, oh, it must have been made by God. Forget that. They'd be looking at it. And even the Egyptians. You know, if I'm an Egyptian soldier and I saw all that happened, says, hey, would you let me stay home today? You know, I don't want to go on this trip to chase these Israelites because look what's happened to all of our cattle and all this and all that. So they go on, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart. Verse 5, and was told the king of Egypt that they had fled. Now, where was the Exodus? Well, I saw a very interesting program yesterday where they found some place in the Gulf of Aqaba where they said they were from chariot wheels and all that. Then you found somebody else said that's a bunch of baloney. And so the point is I'm going to make here, from my what I've seen, nobody really knows for sure. And one of the reasons is time. Because after a period of time, for instance, let me give you an example. Ephesus, we all heard of that, right? You know, Ephesus was on the sea. Adrian or wherever it was. Anyway, so now it's like, what, 10 or 20 or 100 miles inland? And how many times you go in Egypt? I think it's Alexandria. Some of the Egyptian cities are now like 30 feet underwater. So one of the problems with finding, you know, the chariot wheels and all this, it could be buried on 200 feet of mud by this time. We don't know. So I'm very skeptical of almost anybody that says we know exactly where it is. I do think this, though, we've always understood the Exodus. And the first thing I saw on this program I viewed yesterday was it was taking the Israelites about 5 weeks to get there. Well, we've always understood it's like 7 days. It's a rather short time. And that's what I've always understood. And that's a tradition. And so I don't think that that's the one. Right away, my skepticism went up. But again, I don't think we really know. Now, if somebody knows something else, let me know about it. But you can make arguments for all kinds of places. So that's something to keep in mind when you see somebody say, I've proven something, you want to ask some questions. I will give you one example before we go on. There was one major archaeologist, well-known. He's going around all over the United States, and he's making a lot of money, books and all this stuff. And he said he had one of the chariot wheels of the Egyptians. Well, there's a little problem with that. That chariot wheel was what? 1500 B.C., 2,000, around 3,500 years old. What do you think happens to a chariot wheel when it's under the ocean or underwater for about 3,000 years? Right. That was at least the one I saw yesterday said it wasn't there. It's not going to be there. In fact, I saw an internet site where the son said he went down to a local market and bought it. So that was enough of that story. Well, I mean, again, a lot of people have stories like that, so you need to ask a question or two. And they make a lot of money on their books and their videos. That's what happens. So I personally don't think we know exactly. I think we know the approximate area probably, but I don't think we know exactly. All right, so it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled. So he readied his chariot, and he took off after them. And he took 600 choice chariots, all the chariots of Egypt, and the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh. So this is why he did it. You know, Paul even mentions this in, I think, the book of Romans, isn't it? That God hardens some people's hearts. So he was used by God, wasn't he? He was, in a sense, he didn't realize it. Because, by the way, you must realize, too, that they thought of the Pharaohs as gods. So we know the story. The Egyptians pursued them. They get by the sea. And the Israelites, who had seen all these miracles, what's the first thing they do? Panic, right? Human nature. And that's something to remember, too. We have to have control of ourselves. And sometimes it's difficult to have faith, brethren. This Red Sea story is something I'll never forget in 94 and 95 when we had the crisis. It was a member from Akron, by the way, called me and said, you know, we're at the Red Sea and we need a miracle of God. And we did. And we survived, brethren, and always had difficult times. Back to the story here. And they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us? So very sarcastic. Very sarcastically. And Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Boy, there's something that really applies to us, doesn't it? Do not be afraid. When you have faith, what does faith do for you? It helps you overcome fear, doesn't it? And the more that you've experienced things, if you're really converted and with it, it's going to help you. And my wife and I, I'm going to talk to you about some of the miracles in our lives as we go later here in this sermon. But we've seen that. And it helps you when you say, wait a minute, I know what's going to happen. Or somehow, maybe not exactly how it's going to work out, but it'll work out. And so but they didn't have that kind of faith, did they? And so then the Moses said, stand still, don't be afraid. And Lord told Moses, put your hand over the sea. They were the army was going to get them, kill them. And then he says, not only that are you going to go through the sea, but I'm going to harden Pharaoh's hearts, verse 17, and he will follow them into the sea. Now, again, your logical mind would say, wait a minute. If if they can make a wall of water, which the Bible says was on the left and the right, then that wall of water could fall down, couldn't it? And maybe it would be a good idea to stay on the shore, which Yul Brynner in the movie did. Remember that? He stays on the shore. Well, here's one of the things that's really wrong. If you read about Egyptian history, one of the pharaohs the world thinks that was involved in this was Ramses II. Okay? And he's there on watching. I'm sorry, in the ancient times, most of the time, now there were exceptions, but most of the time, the leader, that's what he was. He was a warrior. And by the way, there's a very famous story about, I think it's Carchemish, where Pharaoh went and he led his army. He almost got killed. He almost got killed because he was right in the middle of the battle. He wasn't standing up in a hill like Yul Brynner was. You know, watch, whoa, boy, this is really bad news. He was right down there with them. It had to be. I mean, if you understand now, but some people will say, well, why wasn't Pharaoh? Why didn't they, you know, see his body? Well, how many bodies did they see? They saw a few on the shore, and probably they couldn't see that he was killed. And the Bible clearly says that they had victory over Pharaoh and his army. The Bible is really clear on that as far as I'm concerned. And also it's clear from ancient history. Now, David, remember one time they actually told David not to go because they were afraid he would get killed. He said, well, why don't you stay back? But where would David have been then if he came with his army? He would have been right at the front. Anyway, some people have that. And Moses stretched his hand over the sea then, and it was a wall on the left and a wall on the right. And this is one of the places where they got it right. I thought that was really good in the Ten Commandments movie, where that there was a wall on the left and the right. Now, what did the world say about them? And we know the rest of the story then, that God looked down. And by the way, it actually talks about confounding the people. The Egyptians pursued after them all of Pharaoh's chariots, his horses, and his horsemen. And it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of the fire and a cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians and took off their chariot wheels. Oh, about that time, wouldn't you be running? You know, we're going to get out of this thing. See? And the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand, and the sea came back. Okay, what does the world say about this? Okay. We believe by faith this is what happened. But the world tries to explain it. This is from an internet site. It's abcnews.go.com. And the natural explanation for the miracles. This is what happened, they say. The guy's name is Voltinier and Andrusoff. Calculated the wind blowing at 67 miles an hour would blow the water away at a certain place at the Red Sea. Wow. Well, by the way, would it make a wall? And by the way, most of the time wind goes from what? One direction? Not two directions? So you got a wall on the left and a wall on the right. Well, how does that square? Well, again, you know, I think this is something that'll be relegated to a comic book in the future, I'm sure, you know. This is how they said the Exodus happened and all of that. All right, now, miracles, brethren. Do they convert people? Well, they didn't work on the Israelites at first, did they? Of course, they didn't get the point. Now, also, you got to realize not everybody probably lacked faith. I mean, you just have, in our society today, you have a few people complaining, everybody gets mad, right? And it can happen where you can have a small group. Let's go to Joshua 24 and verse 31. There is a purpose for miracles, brethren. And when you have an open mind, when you have a mind that is open to the truth, which is not what's in the world today, Joshua 24 and verse 31, and this statement comes out two or three times, because even though the Israelites didn't get it during the time, later it shows that there was some conversion that took place. And notice in Joshua 24:31, Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord which he had done to Israel. So there was a group that got the point, that got the meaning of the miracles. And that's a very important point about the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, brethren, that these things were done with a purpose. That Jesus Christ was crucified, that we could see the enormity of sin, as Mr. Hansen was talking about, you know, this story. I don't know about you. At this time of year, it's very difficult at any time of year to read the story from what, Matthew 25 on? And John 18 or 13 or whatever the scriptures go, the last few chapters of Mark, what, 14 to 16? I don't know about you. I struggle to read those. And because of the tremendous suffering that Christ did for us. But the apostles finally got the point, didn't they? But not at first. They didn't get it at all at first, didn't they? They just went and hid. All right, let's go to a couple more scriptures just to reinforce this point. Judges 2 and verse 10. You notice the same thing. And notice it wasn't just the elders now, this is. In Judges 2 and verse 10, when all the generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation rose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. Wow. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, people forgot. You know, we look at the church. Look what happened to the church, brethren. I was thinking about this as I was preparing this sermon. What happened in the 90s? Remember, Mr. Armstrong died when? What, 1986? Within 8 years. Look what happened. It was a younger generation, basically, even though the man in charge was a little older, but they were young men that influenced certain things that were going on, didn't they? And they forgot. And you look at the Bible, brethren, and this is one of the points, and it's a point of faith, and it's very difficult. It's important, by the way, that we have the youth programs and these youth programs in Pittsburgh and the prom that you have and the camps that we have. All of them, I tell you, I'm very supportive of. It's great. It's wonderful. We have to teach our children. But historically, brethren, it's one of the most difficult things for us to do, isn't it? I mean, you know who Hezekiah's son was? Remember? Manasseh. Who was Josiah's son? Those have been hearing Dr. Levy's books in Jeremiah. What did his sons do? Wow. It's a kind of a sobering thing to keep in mind. We must do everything we can, of course. But the historical evidence of this is something to keep in mind, that once those who had seen the miracles died, then the younger generation came out. Oh, those are just stories, probably what they said. Well, who cares? Well, it's really nice to serve Moloch. I don't know what's nice about that, to sacrifice your kids. You know, but that's apparently what they thought. You know, it's amazing how these people think that paganism is so good. It is not. Paganism is a very detrimental thing to believe in. It doesn't have the high standards of the Bible. A lot of the pagans had temples for prostitutes. They called them temple prostitutes. They worshiped sex. And you can see that happening today. So, again, that's something, you know, to keep in mind. All right. Is there evidence outside the Bible for the Exodus? Well, let's go on to what people do today. You know, how many times does every... By the way, West Virginia won, okay? I don't know about you, when West Virginia wins, I live in Ohio, but I'm still kind of a fan. Morgantown, you know what I mean? And West Virginia won, that's great. But when they lose, do you go to the paper? Oh, I want to see how they lost. I don't know about you, I kind of avoid that paper, you know? That's the way I am. I mean, how many times when your team loses, do you want, oh boy, well, there was the last second, the guy threw up the ball, the three-point shot. That's what happened, by the way, in the tournament. I can't remember which game. We don't, do we? We naturally do that. Do governments get up and make big monuments and say, boy, this was great, we lost World War II? or whatever. Any of you been to Hawaii, to Pearl Harbor? Yeah. Okay. We were there, I think, Cheryl, we were there twice, weren't we? You know one of the most, a lot of the people are there, who they are? The Japanese. It's just a way, we're all that way. And we commemorate our victories, don't we? We put monuments to them. But to our defeats, well, we may do something. At Gettysburg, you can find monuments to both sides, of course. But we always tend. And that's the same way with the ancients. Remember the name Ramses II. Now, I want to get into this now. But there's no question in my mind that there's something wrong with the world's ideas about the Egyptian chronologies. They're obviously too long. You can read a couple books by David Rawls, one of them, Pharaohs and Kings and others. I don't know if he's got it right. I don't know if anybody knows for sure. But one thing I think is fairly obvious to most conservative Christian scholars is there's something wrong with the Egyptian chronologies. They're stretched too long. And, you know, we see that happen over and over. But anyway, if you take Ramses II, what we know about him from his, from, you know, the monuments he's built. And he has this, Kadesh is where the battle was. I was talking about, not Carchemish, there's another one. Kadesh. He fought this very famous battle with the Hittites at Kadesh. And at Kadesh, when he fought the battle, he got up there, it was in Syria, and he just about got killed. I mean, it was just a fraction. Fortunately, the Hittites had deceived them. They had a spy come in, and you can read the story if you want. Some Egyptian papyruses show what happened, Egyptian records anyway. And he almost got killed. And in reality, the best he could say, it was a draw. Really, it was a defeat because he was going to kick the Hittites out of there, and he didn't do it. But on the monuments you see in Egypt, they don't talk about that. They say, oh, our glorious king was so bold and brave and all of that. You never get the idea. Well, he had to go back to Egypt and really, in reality, I think I would say he was defeated because he didn't attain his goal of defeating the Hittites. And so it's very obvious, and even other commentators have said, the Egyptians don't make monuments to defeats, do they? Oh, by the way, here's a stellar. These Israelite slaves came up and their God killed and decimated our gods, and there they are, they're gone. They're not going to build a monument to that, are they? I mean, it's obvious. Oh, but the skeptics will say, well, there's no record of it. Well, that is not really true. In the first place, there are several ideas and things. And now, again, let's remember that things are interpretive. And I'm not sure if you can say that everything, you know, it's so hard to know exactly when something occurred. But let me put it this way. There are Egyptian records that show great similarities to the Exodus. And one of them was, another minister mentioned it to me, by the way. It's called the Ipuwer Papyrus. Have you ever heard of it? The Ipuwer Papyrus. You probably haven't because it gets swallowed up in the world. And of course, the first thing the world will say, well, this can't be, you know, the Exodus. It just reminds me of Jericho. We couldn't go to Jericho when Cheryl and I were in Israel because it's controlled by the Palestinians. And they wouldn't take us in there, our Jewish guides. But there's a place where the wall falls down and the world decides, well, that couldn't have been done by the Israelites. But what famous story we have in the world that, of a wall falling down? Okay, and I don't know if we can say absolutely for sure this proves it, but it proves this, that the Egyptians did have in their history, by their own admission, events that sure sound a lot like the Exodus. And if you want to get it, you can go to users/user/documents/creation. And if you just type it in, by the way, Google it, Ipuwer Papyrus, it'll come right up for you. And of course, the skeptics don't believe it. But this is a little bit from that article. Century, a papyrus dating from the Middle Kingdom was found in Egypt. It was taken to the Leiden Museum in Holland. The complete papyrus can be found in the Book of the Admonitions of the Egyptian. The papyrus describes violent upheavals in Egypt. And the papyrus was written by an Egyptian named Ipuwar, I-P-U-W-A-R. The way they spelled it in one place, I-P-A-W, but I-P-U-W-A-R. And it appears to be an eyewitness account of the effects of the Exodus. Now, of course, some are going to argue about that. But regardless, these are some of the things that it says. It happened to Egypt at one time. A plague is throughout the land. Blood is everywhere. Recognize that story? Okay. The river is blood. Well, men shrink from tasting. Human beings and thirst after water. It wasn't anything to drink. It was, you know, the Bible says it was blood. That is our water. This is what happened, what we do. Forsooth, gates, columns, and walls are consumed by fire. What was one of the miracles of the Bible? Remember that? The hail comes down. What happens? It turns to fire. Lower Egypt weeps. The entire palace is without its revenues. To it belong wheat and barley and fish. What was destroyed? The crops, weren't they? Forsooth, grain has perished on every side. Forsooth, that has perished which was yesterday seen. The land is left over. You go on. All animals and their hearts weep. I won't read all of them to you. You can pick it up yourself if you want to see. But one of the most interesting ones, it talks about the slaves. It says female slaves are leaving with their necks fastened with bronze and gold. Recognize that story? When they left Egypt? Now, I don't think we can say absolutely that proves the Exodus happened. That's not the point. Point is that the Egyptians have records that sound an awful lot like the Exodus. But again, I get back to the sermon here. You know, faith. If you have faith, you're going to look at it, well, that sure sounds like it. If you're somebody who doesn't believe in God, you say, well, that can't be right. It wouldn't matter. It wouldn't matter. God has given us miracles. And evidence of miracles, if you want. And you can look at other points in history where they made tremendous mistakes, like the Hittites supposedly didn't exist. And then they discovered in the early 1900s, I think it was. There they are. Not only did they exist, they were a huge empire. And the Egyptians were fighting them and all of that. All right, let's go to the New Testament then, miracles. And how do we know those happened? Well, ultimately, again, brethren, it's faith. John 11, probably one of the greatest miracles of the Bible. And that's something to keep in mind. We had a funeral a week or so ago, and the chaplain, it was a military funeral, part of it was a military funeral, and they actually quoted from the book of John, John 11, 25. And I sat there, wow. And it was really something. But here is one of the greatest miracles of the Bible, the raising of Lazarus. And it happens, by the way, and what's interesting, too, when you read the book of John, brethren, most of you probably realize, is the book of John fills in the gaps. You wouldn't know about the woman at the well. There are several events that are recorded in the book of John that are not in the other Gospels. Well, for obvious reasons, John was written later, probably around 90 AD, and he was filling in the gaps. And apparently, for whatever reason, the other Gospels leave out this miracle. I think it's because it was so close to the death of Christ. And the others just focus on that. But whatever reason, here it is. There's a certain man named Lazarus. You probably all know the story. Jesus actually delays in coming to him, and he tells his apostles, he says, well, this has happened that you might understand in the glory of God. And he said, obviously, you see the scriptures, obviously he waited till he died. And it's interesting to me, though, the apostles, they still hadn't gotten the point, had they? Because Lazarus wasn't the first one that Jesus raised from the dead, was he? What was it? A woman, that widow woman had, you know, there was a grave thing going on, and his son had raised or whatever, and there's several of them. There's the one of the Jewish leaders' daughters is raised from the dead. And they knew about that, but they still didn't believe, did they? Actually didn't believe until the resurrection, the Holy Spirit comes, until that really gets it. So again, Christ goes and he talks to them and he raises Lazarus from the dead. This is quite a miracle. He walks out in his grave clothes. They have to take him out. In fact, One of the sisters says to one of the sisters, says, "Well, he stinks. He's been dead." And all of that. And they just don't get it, do they? They just don't get it. And one of the most interesting scriptures in the Bible to me is where Jesus Christ says in John 11:43, "Lazarus, come forth. Lazarus, come forth." And he comes out. Now, brethren, I suppose you could go in history. Maybe you could find somebody named Lazarus. But that wouldn't prove he was raised from the dead, would you? See the point? I mean, even if you go to proofs of the Bible, at some point, the only way to know and to is to believe, isn't it? Is to have faith. And unfortunately, we live in a society today that's filled with doubt. It is a struggle at times because everybody seems to doubt. I know when we visited some of Cheryl's relatives, one of her nephews actually said, "Well, I can't believe the Bible because it was written by men." Well, God works through men, doesn't he? It's just so hard for them to get it. And so it's an important point to recognize, you know, that miracles happen. John 11:46. So Christ raises Lazarus from the dead. Boy, what a miracle. Everybody hears about it. In fact, if you read the scriptures, it says many of the Jews were converted, you know, started to realize. Verse 45, then many of the Jews had come to Mary and had seen the things that Jesus did, believed in him. Well, miracles do have an effect on you, don't they? But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them what they did. And later on, then, if you read later on, I think it's in John 12, not only did some of the Jews not get it, but they were so angry about this miracle of Christ raising Lazarus from the dead that they tried to kill him also. So much for miracles converting people. Eh? If you're carnal and you're not going to believe something, I don't care what you say. That's why, brethren, we've learned years ago, Mr. Armstrong used to tell us, don't try to convert your relatives. And, you know, we've all done that. Well, I don't know if we've all done it, but I did it. It wasn't my relative. It was one of the roommates at Washington State University. I sat him down and explained to him about the Sabbath day. Had the book with the mark of the beast. I learned real quickly that was not a good idea. That wasn't the way to do it. It didn't have any effect. You know, if anything, it made things worse. If somebody doesn't have an open mind, whatever they see, it's not going to convict them, is it? And you have to have faith, and you have to have also a mind that is willing to accept and have God's Spirit, of course, work with you. The Bible says that God calls those, of course. All right, what's one of the greatest miracles in the New Testament? Well, probably the greatest miracle, Matthew 12 and verse 40. And this time of year, we all know the 3 days and three nights, and that's an important point, of course. You know, we're talking about the Good Friday, Easter Sunday tradition, which is wrong, and it's so hard for so many to understand it. Even commentaries like Barclay's commentary, you know what he says about this? Matthew got it wrong. Yeah, he's supposed to be good, and Mr. Johnson mentions that too in his lectures. Or it might have been Mr. Thompson. And one of the two mentions it. And it's amazing how somebody supposedly believes the Bible and he's, oh, well, he just got it wrong. Why? Because it's obvious what it's stating. But the most important part of the scripture is that Jesus Christ was going to be raised from the dead. That's the big thing. That's the big news. You know, that Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. Matthew 27 and verse 63. This is one of the great miracles of the Bible. Now, the good news about these things, brethren, is that, for instance, what have they found? The tomb of Caiaphas and some of them, or the ossuary. There's evidence of Pilate. The archaeological evidence is pretty good in the New Testament. Whereas the Old Testament is different because it's so old that it's all buried or it's gone or whatever. So it's more difficult for them to dispute, some still do, by the way, that Jesus Christ lived. But now to believe in his resurrection is something else, isn't it? Matthew 27 and verse 63. And after 3 days, notice that the Pharisees even knew this prediction of Christ. And they say, after 3 days, I will rise. And that's why they put the guards out there. Notice the term, too, after 3 days. It's so obvious in the Bible it is. And what's interesting about these scriptures, too, brethren, is what happens after Christ is risen. Do the apostles say, aha, Christ is risen, I'm going to believe? What happens to them at first? They don't believe it, do they? We even have this term today called Doubting Thomas, right? And it says, I stick my hand in his side and all this. And of course, in John, you can read a bit in the book of John. And then he believes. And then what does Christ say? Blessed are those who have not seen, but believe. Faith is so important, brethren. And again, you can prove everything. There's no greater proof, brethren, that God is working with us than what happens to you and to me. And Cheryl and I were in Africa for 4.5 years. When you have a miracle happen to you, and something, remember the definition of a miracle. The definition of a miracle is something very unusual, extraordinary. It might be a close call. And I'll tell you about one close call. Cheryl and I were in Zambia, and it was one of the cities. And in South Africa, Southern Africa, when they drive, they have vans. And there are 16-passenger vans, and they have this great big huge mirror that's on both sides, like a truck. You ever seen the trucks with those? They have those with the great big mirrors. And I was walking on the left side of the road. Remember, it's a British. You can blame them for that, by the way. There was Zambia. So when I walked, and I just had an instinct to take a step to the left. Well, afterwards, I remember Andre Van Belkom, and my wife saw it too. That mirror missed my head in Zambia by about an inch. I don't know what it was. Very close. If I hadn't taken a step to the left, I wouldn't be here today. Mr. Hanson would have to give the sermon. I shouldn't. If I hadn't taken a step to the left, I just, for whatever reason, I felt I should take a step. And, wow. I mean, we've had all kinds of things in our lives where we can see one little tiny thing differently would have meant that we're not here. And whatever. We had some other incidences. One of the most scary was we were in Malawi. I think it was a little long way, but anyway, we had a place that we stayed in Malawi, and one night they had it was a whole kind of a motel kind of thing, or whatever you want to call it, and they had a house that they converted, like 3 or 4 of the bedrooms, and they were rooms. So we went down there not thinking about it, and we stayed over, and it was Friday night, of course, and so we were in our room. There were 3 other bedrooms. I think there were 3 or 4 bedrooms, and sure enough, some Muslims came in. And of all times, and they happen to have satellite TV. By the way, I wish they hadn't had satellite TV. Because President Bush was on there saying they were going to attack Iraq. Okay? So they come in the room, and my wife, she is very sensitive about things. Me, we won't get into that, okay? But my wife, she starts listening to, in fact, I think she put a cup up to the door, and words like jihad came out. And if we did this tonight, we would go to heaven or something like that. Now, I didn't hear this. My wife did, so I believe her, okay? Well, needless to say, we had one of the scariest nights. I don't think we've ever had a scarier night in our lives, have we, Cheryl? But sure enough, and then in the morning when they pray, oh, wow, that's scary. And they pray to Jesus, by the way, and all of that. Well, finally, we survived the night. And we got up in the morning, and we were out of there. And the lady said, well, you want to stay down there another night? No, we'll stay up here. And another time, this is one that we thought we were goners. We were up in a place called Kitwe, visiting some brethren up there. And Andre Van Belkom was with us. Now, he'd had a lot of experience in Africa, and we had just been there a couple months. This is about the fall of 2002. So as we go to Canada, and by the way, in the United States, we can be thankful. We don't have roadblocks. We had no roadblocks on the way up here. We saw three cops, by the way, giving tickets. So watch out. Watch out on 70, okay? But that's all we saw. But when you go to Zambia and even Johannesburg, you can get stopped. One time we were stopped in Pretoria for 2 hours. So we were stopped every, 100 miles or so. You'd have to stop. And you have to show, by the way, your insurance, what they made you buy at the border, which is no good, but, you know, you bought it anyway. You paid the government. Well, there was this police officer there, and you get a sense about, somebody, bad vibes. One of the guys around, I think, had a AK-47, whatever, one of his rifles on his back, and he let us go. I thought, wow, what's going on here? And I was surprised, because I thought he was going to hassle us, I could tell. Well, on the way back, in Zambia and Malawi and some of these places, there are no signs in some places. So we watched the road that we came on, and unbeknownst to us, it was a one-way street. But there was no signs that do not enter, believe me. And so we go down this, and we see this same guy. We made our visit in Zambia. Everything went fine. We made this visit in Zambia, and we come to this cop, and he says, "You're in trouble." Why? What do we do? Well, we went down a one-way street backwards. Well, we've been in trouble in the United States for that, too, you know. But he says, "You're in trouble." And then I said, "Well, sir, there were no signs." Then he says, "Are you calling me a liar?" Now, this is one time, brethren, I was very smart. I didn't say a word. Not with an AK-47 on your back. "No, I'm not going to call you a liar." You know, I sat there like that. And so then he said, "Oh, by the way, you're good citizens." Now, I didn't think we were very good citizens because even Andre, Mr. Van Belkom, was with us. He was arguing with him, too. We were kind of, you know, talking to him, and we learned. And he knew how to handle these kind of things. And he said, "Oh, by the way, I'll tell you what. I'll let you off the hook. And by the way, before they said, I'm going to take you to the police station." You know what that meant. Jail time. You'd be looking at a jailbird here. For that, you know. Anyway, he said, "I'll take you to the police station." "Oh, no, we didn't want to do that." They said, "Oh, I'll tell you what, I'll let you go since you're such good citizens, and if you'll give this buddy of mine a ride." Well, now, we'd heard about hijackings before. And in South Africa, Zambia is known. In fact, Kambani Banda, our minister there, had to take his car to the police station at night because he lived in Lusaka. So I said, "Oh, boy, we are goners." And this guy had a little bag in the, you know, one of these little kind of a bag of something, and he put it up right behind my head. And I'm driving down the road, and I'm thinking, Cheryl and I, it's goodbye, you know. And that's it. You know, we've had it. So we gave him some candy, so we might as well die happy, we thought, you know, whatever. And we did all of that, and we go about, I think about 200 miles. And boy, we were sweating. My blood pressure must have been terrible during that time. And finally we get to Lusaka. Here we've had all this problems stopping at these signs, and every time we came to one of these police stops, guess what they did? He raised his hand in the back. "Oh, you can go." Nobody checked this. It turned out he was a police officer, of course, and they knew that. Well, when we got to Lusaka, instead of being hijacked, guess what? He gets out and waves and says, "Goodbye," and everything is fine. Blood pressure goes down, you know. Well, it turned out all he wanted was a ride. But Andre hadn't told us that. You know, he talked about that, how sometimes the man to ride. I thought we were hijacked. I thought that was it. You know? And so Cheryl and I, we went through that experience. And that was when a little bit of a false alarm. But I also felt that God protected us. And we've just seen it, you know, so many times. So many times when God has intervened for us. And he's helped us. And there's nothing better, you know, than have a miracle. A very unusual situation that you get out of. And you know, we all have close calls sometimes, of course. All right. So what about our little orchid, guys? We'll put it up here, okay? Better looking than I am, isn't it? Okay. All right. What is miraculous about this orchid? Called photosynthesis. I'm not going to read to you the Encarta definition. I've got it in notes here. But I'll read you a general what Encarta says about it. Photosynthesis, the process by which green plants and certain other organisms use the energy of light to convert carbon dioxide and water into simple sugar glucose. Oh, sugar. We all like that in our Cokes, right? Whatever, we get cakes and pies and all of that. It takes light and it converts carbon dioxide, which we all breathe out, and it turns it into sugar, which can be used for energy. And by the way, people say they don't see miracles today. You know what happens? We actually live in a miracle, brethren. The earth that we live in is a miracle. The earth that we live in has all kinds, like photosynthesis. How can you ever explain that? When you go to the technical definition, you want to do look it up sometime. You'll find it talks about how one electron is moved from this place to that place and up and down and boom, boom, boom. Finally, you come out, you know, with sugar. A miracle. Remember the definition of a miracle? A wonder. You don't have to look at the Bible and never see miracles, frankly. And they are miracles. We should believe in them, of course. There are miracles. The Exodus is a miracle. The resurrection of Christ is a miracle. The only way that you can ever understand a miracle is to have faith and believe. And God has given us miracles. And I'm sure that if some of you were talking to you afterwards, you'll tell me about your miracles and how God intervened for you. And we can look at that and look in our personal lives and see that over and over again. So in conclusion, brethren, the upcoming Holy Days picture the greatest miracles of the Bible, really. Let's believe in that.